Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are mid-election, a few days to go. I am joined, Rory Hearn, your host, and joined today by Dr. Tom. Tom, your name has gone out of my head.
Tom McDonald.
That'll tell you where my head is at now. Tom McDonald from the Nevin Economic Research Institute, director, isn't that right, Tom? That's it, yeah. And Tricia Keelty. Tricia, I didn't forget your name. Head of Social Justice with St. Vincent de Paul. I'm delighted to have you with us.
Thanks for having us.
Great. So we are talking economics of the election, the economic policies, analysing them, going through them, discussing inequality, poverty, and where is it in the election. Tricia, what's been your sense of the debate so far?
So far, I think there's been rightly a focus on housing and healthcare. I suppose from our point of view, there hasn't been much discussion on poverty more generally, income inequality, social welfare. I suppose we would have been in our election priorities that we would have published last week. We were keen for manifesto writers to include a specific target in relation to poverty reduction. Now, some have included, for example, Labour, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil have included a commitment to eradicate child poverty, which is really important. But then many of them don't include commitment to actually increase social welfare. So it's virtually impossible to eradicate poverty if you're not going to at least index link social welfare rates to average earnings, because you're not going to reduce inequality. And Tom would have been discussing that as well.
Is this part of the problem of lots of commitments and no actual plan to implement or to achieve it?
Yeah, I suppose the biggest challenge in terms of poverty anyway is kind of joined up thinking across various policy areas. So obviously, fundamentally, it's impossible to get out of poverty if you don't have a roof over your head. So you need, firstly, to have adequate housing. And you know, there's been strong ambition there from a lot of the parties around the public provision of social and affordable housing. We were also keen that there would be a cost rental model in the new programme for government. And a lot of the parties are talking about that as well. So that's really important. I suppose it'll all come down to what actually ends up in the programme for government and the negotiations that get underway once the election is done and dusted. And I suppose we'll be interested to see where those different priorities that we've laid out fall and how they are going to be implemented over the course of the next government.
And you had specifically, because I was quite struck by, like, it has been, you know, great to see, you know, the issue of housing and health being to the forefront and in people's concerns as well. It's so heartening, and hopefully we will see a big change reflected in policies as a result of that. But to me, kind of looking at it, the question of poverty itself hasn't really been directly talked about. Like child poverty, in my seeing it anyway, and in the debates as such. And do you get that sense as well that the...
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the numbers are stark in terms, like, they're still there in terms, you know, 120,000 children in poverty.
So there's almost 700,000 people living below the poverty line, and about 230,000 are children. So we have seen a reduction in consistent poverty over the last number of years among children. So about the budget before the last one, or the 2017, about 25,000 children were lifted out of poverty. And again, that relates to the increases in social welfare and investment in some supports, for example, hot school meals. And there's been also commitments around free education, which is really important as well from our point of view. And a lot of the parties have committed to at least introducing free, genuinely free primary education over the next programme for government. And that's something that's really achievable. But I think generally, there has been less focus on poverty more generally and the issue of income inequality. We're talking about tax and how that can impact on the distribution of income, and also the role of social welfare, which is featured less, I suppose, in the debate. We will be saying that over the programme, the next programme for government, you need to benchmark social welfare rates against the cost of a minimum essential standard of living. And that means that people have an adequate income to not only meet their basic needs, but also access opportunities. I suppose there's often a reluctance to increase social welfare rates because there's a prevailing assumption that if welfare is too generous, however you want to define that, people won't actively look for a job. But research shows that in countries that have generous welfare payments, like the Nordic countries, that is combined with good opportunities, strong protections for workers, a living wage, affordable childcare, then adequate social welfare actually works to move people into sustainable and decent work rather than pushing people into low paid work that leads back to cycles of unemployment for people and not actually moving people out of poverty for good and not into working poverty, I suppose, as well. So I think there needs to be a discussion on how we see the entire social welfare system and the role it plays, both in ensuring people aren't falling below a standard that we should have for everybody in all of society, and how that system works to improve employment outcomes for people that can work.
And you had a specific call in your own proposal, St. Vincent de Paul's proposals around the programme for government and the election for a poverty, what did you just call it?
Poverty Reduction Act.
Yes, a Poverty Reduction Act, and for poverty proofing. And you just talk about a parliamentary oversight committee. What do you mean by a Poverty Reduction Act?
So we would have looked at other countries that have been placing poverty and the need to address it at the top of their national agenda. So, for example, Scotland, New Zealand and Canada have introduced legislation which makes their poverty targets legally binding. So we've been, the climate action plan and the climate action law talks about making the carbon targets, climate change targets, legally binding. So we were saying, well, we also need to make our poverty targets legally binding so that we can address both issues, because the drivers of both climate change and poverty are the same. So if you want to do that, you need to put them on an equal footing on a legislative basis, because we have had strategies and policies to address poverty. We've had a target to reduce consistent poverty to 2% or less, going back to the early 90s. And we've never met that. So what happens is that poverty targets...
So you're saying the target is 2%, and what are we at about now?
6%.
6%.
Yeah, so it has come down a good bit, but...
And is there an issue around poverty measurements, that it's not capturing...
Absolutely, yeah.
...the real extent of poverty?
One of the big issues that we would say in terms of how you measure poverty at the moment is that it doesn't account for housing costs. So in the UK, you measure people's disposable income after you account for housing costs, but we don't. So even if you look at the calls that come into to Vincent de Paul and the trends in that over time, we would have seen that our calls would have increased substantially over the course of the recession, obviously. And they started to come down, but in recent years, they've gone back up again. And we see that the biggest driver there is housing costs. So it's not, even though our poverty rate is falling, there is other factors that are driving the poor living standards, and that's housing costs. So we need to think about including housing costs in how we measure poverty, but also just in terms of the 60% poverty line. So our poverty line is calculated based on the proportion of households who have an income below 60% of the average income.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
But that's kind
of... So the average income is if you're going 40,000... And then they're basically, you're below poverty, you're in poverty if you're below 60% of that 40,000.
So in last year, that would equate it to about €260 per week.
Yeah.
But what is the purchasing power of that? And how does that incorporate the cost of services? Because our poverty line may be higher or lower than other countries, but what is the experience of people living below that? How can they, what is the purchasing power? How can they access services? So we think the benchmark that the Vincentian Partnership for Social Justice derives, which establishes what is the minimum essential standard of living for Ireland and how is that calculated? What are the basket of goods you need to participate in Irish society on an equal level to everybody? And what is the cost of that? So that would be €245 for a single adult, but then it changes obviously if you have children. So that takes in a more all-encompassing view of poverty. It's not just about income, but it's also about what you, how you can access services and the cost of that.
And it does seem to be like that idea you're saying, that like the calls to St. Vincent de Paul and the number of people seeking support from St. Vincent de Paul has increased. At the same time, poverty rates are dropping. There seems to be a contradiction there.
Yeah.
So the poverty rates then are not capturing the level of poverty and need that's out there.
No, and I think it gives us some indication. It tells us what is happening to income, but it doesn't capture effectively how people are able to access things like health and housing. So there is other complementary measures in SILC. They do measure housing costs. They do measure access to services, but it's not collected every year. So we would like to see more complementary measures. For example, another indicator of poverty is how many people are using money lenders.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have enough money to meet your basic needs, and people are driven to high cost money lenders. So 350,000 people used money lenders in Ireland last year, which gives you an indication of...
That's an incredible number.
Yeah. It gives you an indication of the...
incredible number of people under huge distress and to have to go to that level.
And very high cost credit that they have no other option. And that's, you know, we would see people going to money lenders to pay for things like back to school, or even if they have an electricity bill that they can't afford. So these kind of reasons, very basic reasons, that people need to either access charitable assistance or money lenders to actually meet their basic needs.
So you think a poverty act would...
It would be an accountability structure. Obviously, that's not going to be enough. You need investment in all those core areas. Mm. So we've also called for investment in housing, benchmarking social welfare rates, investment in education, and also investment in measures to tackle fuel and transport poverty. But we would see it as a mechanism for, firstly, the Act would establish a parliamentary oversight so that there would be accountability in the Oireachtas on how Ireland is tackling poverty and what the measures are being put in place and how well they're working. We'd also want to make sure all budgets are poverty proofed and all policies are poverty proofed. And this is particularly relevant to climate action as well. And that the Minister for Finance would have to produce a report in advance of the budget outlining how the various budget measures are going to actually reduce poverty. And if they're not going to reduce poverty, then they need to be amended so that they do.
Okay.
So that would be the purpose of the Act. It would be something that then would make it less vulnerable to election cycles and economic cycles, in that there was a legislative underpinning for actually action. So it would be just putting it more front and centre at the top of the agenda.
Mm. What do you think, Tom? It's a good idea?
I think it's a great idea. And look, we have a fiscal council to see how we're doing with our deficits and debts. Having an equivalent council of experts who could look at the budget and what's being proposed, and analyse that well in advance of the budget, even from January, February onwards, to identify the measures individually, but also as a whole, because not every single measure can be poverty-proofed. But in aggregate, on a year-to-year basis, we should be looking at producing budgets that will reduce poverty and deprivation, and indeed reduce income and wealth inequality. And given that Ireland is well off at world leaders in all of those areas, we have significant scope to improve year on year. So there shouldn't be a constraint on economic growth or anything like that.
And just in terms of you wrote an article there earlier in the week, and a blog as well, around inequality, because it has come up to a certain extent in the discussions. The, you know, government has been claiming that they've, you know, reduced poverty and they have addressed inequality, and we are, you know, we have the most progressive redistributive tax system in Europe, and, you know, that inequality is reduced. But what do you think in terms of the policies? You point out that the policies around tax cuts in particular, that if they are introduced, we could see inequality worsening.
Yeah, well, for example, we've seen some policies looking at increasing the standard rate income tax threshold up to 50,000.
Yeah.
Which would disproportionately benefit the top 25% of households. And that would push Ireland into the top 10 worst countries in terms of income inequality in the European Union. Removing the USC completely, as has been proposed in the past, or less so in this particular election, would be even more damaging in terms of income inequality. We have a very, very unequal market distribution of income. Therefore, our tax system.
That means the income that people get before the tax system.
Before tax and benefits.
Yeah, exactly.
Therefore, and for that reason, our tax system has to work extremely hard just to bring us up to the middle of the table. So we're not a good performer in terms of income inequality. We're slap bang in the middle. And if we are to increase the, if we are to make our tax system less progressive, which you might do, for example, by increasing taxes on consumption, things like carbon tax or VAT or excise, that will increase inequality. But I suppose more directly, if you reduce the tax burden or tax take on higher income households, then you move us into the cohort of worst countries in Europe in terms of income inequality. And we've seen some proposals along those lines. And of course, we also have to look at the...
And which proposals are bringing us along those lines?
Yeah, well, I suppose the most damaging proposal I've seen so far is the one to increase the standard rate threshold to 50,000. Only a minority of households would actually benefit from that. And these are the households by and large that are not experiencing poverty and deprivation almost by definition, because they are high income households. And there would be almost no economic benefit to that. There would be a sugar rush to the economy from the tax cut. There'd be increased spending in year one. There'd be a boost to economic growth in 2021, let's say. But that would just wash out by 2022, 2023, and we just end up with a larger deficit with higher incomes for people at the top and effectively less space to spend money on things like reducing the cost of childcare, building a better public transport system, increasing social benefits and so on.
And obviously I don't agree with this, but just to put it to you, and you know, in terms of arguing and trying to understand it, that, you know, the counter argument is you have this squeezed middle while they're not in poverty or meeting poverty figures. Effectively, they are in a form of poverty in a sense that, you know, the childcare costs, they have nothing left at the end of the month after childcare costs are paid, after a mortgage or rent is paid, health costs are paid, they have nothing left. So giving, you know, this bit back in the tax would help them a bit.
So rather than targeting their disposable income directly, what you can do is you can actually reduce the cost of living itself. So that obviously refers to rents and childcare costs, where Ireland is particularly out of line with other countries. So targeted attempts to increase the welfare state so as to reduce the cost of living for hard-pressed families would be a better strategy overall. And you can combine a lot of these policies with attempts to reduce our carbon emissions as well. So, for example, the idea of free public transport, ultimately for everybody, would help reduce our carbon emissions, would also reduce barriers to employment, particularly for people on low incomes. It would allow them to travel further, for example. This is particularly relevant outside of the cities, and would act as a reduction in the cost of living. I mean, that's just one example. The classic example in Ireland that everyone is aware of is the extreme cost of childcare. Only the United States is worse. And the consequence of that is that we have very low employment rates for second earners and lone parents. There's obviously a massive gender dimension to that. But one of the reasons why we have such a high level of income inequality before tax and benefits are accounted for is that we have a high level of inactive households. And one of the reasons for that is it is too expensive to access employment. Because you have to pay for childcare costs, and you also have to, in many cases, travel. So free public transport and free childcare, 100% subsidy, make them public sector workers. That is the way ultimately to approach this over the next 5 to 10 years. Absolutely free childcare.
Not even 100 a month.
Not even 100 a month. Make it completely free. It's a barrier to employment. There is a gender dimension to it. It's bad for the economy. It reduces our employment rate. You are removing the most educated and talented people from the workforce, which is to say, usually women in their 30s and early 40s, at the peak of their productivity. It is an absolute no brainer in the long term to make childcare.
So how should childcare be provided then?
It should ultimately be provided for by treating them as public sector workers, and it should be no different to how we deal with primary and secondary
education. So the state provides childcare?
So the state does it. Absolutely.
Tricia, do you agree with that?
Yeah, we would agree with that, yeah, as well. And I think the use of subsidies isn't going to be a sustainable approach, and we need a big shift in how we think about the provision of childcare. And it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to require, you know, a lot of planning. And the Department of Children are reviewing the funding model for childcare. They have an expert review group, so we'll see what comes out of that, you know.
And we spend significantly less as a state compared to the size of the economy than do the Nordic countries, for example, that Tricia mentioned earlier. They have much higher employment rates, particularly for women, particularly for lone parents.
Yeah, no, it's. I'll stop pretending that I disagree now. And with young kids in childcare as well, you see it like in terms of the cost is just unreal. It actually is unreal. It's a second housing, like rent equivalent to rent or mortgage in terms of if you've one or two or three kids in childcare. And like what always strikes me as well is that idea of the childcare workers themselves. And there's one thing is the issue of pay, and they need to be paid properly, but also the issue of training, of them having time to develop themselves, to provide care. And when they're stretched, you see it, you know, they can't provide the care. And it's like we don't value children at that age.
Yeah. And it's about affordability for households, but it's also about enabling childcare workers to make it a profession and a career.
Exactly.
For themselves, to have a career progression where they can earn a significant and meaningful income that they can survive on themselves.
Plus also then you don't have this huge turnover of staff, which you'll see in a lot of creches, which affects children. And I think part of it is because there isn't enough talk about, well, what impact do these early years in childcare centres have on children in terms of that importance of nurturing that developmental early years stage?
And we know that that the returns to education, but also this applies to childcare more generally, are highest at the very, very bottom. They're much, much higher than they are for primary, second, third.
What do you mean in terms of early years intervention, early years support?
Absolutely, particularly for households that are at risk of poverty. That is the part of the education budget, and obviously the childcare component of it, that is most helpful in the long term in terms of economic growth. I know we don't just care about economic growth, but poverty is the single biggest barrier to you being able to contribute to the economy over the long term, and childhood poverty in particular. And the evidence shows that once you do fall behind at school, it is extremely difficult to catch up. So if we are investing more in education, for example, that would be the first place you do it. Reduce class sizes, make sure that there's adequate childcare, free food, free books, everything like that.
And has any of the manifestos come out with something very good around childcare or very bad around childcare that has struck you? Or what do you think of? Have you looked at the proposals around childcare?
I haven't looked at them in depth yet, but I know a few are proposing a public provision of childcare and how that will be achieved over the lifetime of the government. Move away from the national childcare scheme and the subsidy based model. Mm. And also a lot of parties are also talking about the childcare workers and having a living wage at a minimum and moving towards that. But it's a really important point around, you know, the primary recipient of childcare is children, and making it a child-centred service has to be at the forefront and has to be at the core of what it is. And it's so, like, the research is unequivocal in terms of giving children the best start in life and having that knock-on effect throughout their lives.
Absolutely. And I could see it in terms of having a large evidence base at home to look at and even having children gone to different creches and seen the different impact of different approaches, like the, you might call a less maybe kind of developmental approach or staff with not as much maybe training or not as having the same capacity, that the impact that poor early years kind of care can have on children is quite profound.
It is.
And I, you know, I've seen it on my children in terms of, you know, quite been upset by, you know, certain treatment, and then seeing other places where you see the children flourish, like absolutely flourish with, you know, a different approach and different care. And so you see, like, this is really a profound age. And I think it is something generally about us as a society understanding children. Like, you know, we've gone from fucking, you know, abusing and locking up to now, thankfully, a point where we actually value children understand them. But I do think part of this is part of our process of growing up as a society.
I couldn't agree more. And for me, if there was to be one significant radical policy change which would make us a better society and economy over the long term, it would be proper childcare, fully paid for by the state, highly professional people caring for children, removing all of those barriers. Good for the economy, good for people's development, their agency, their ability to be part of society. Hugely important. I mean, there's other areas too which you could point to, but I suppose if I would have one main concern about the debate so far is that there has been this emphasis rather than on things like income inequality and indeed wealth inequality, which we probably should talk about too.
Yeah.
Is this focus on giveaway tax cuts?
Yeah, yeah. I was quite struck by that at the leaders' debate. Yeah. It was like, in a way, every party, I think, talked about tax cuts, except maybe Labour and the Social Democrats. But
I think that's true, and yeah, possibly the Greens as well. I'm not entirely sure.
Fundable tax credit for low income workers.
Yeah. But all the left as well, Sinn Féin and People for Profit, they all promised tax cuts as well.
Yeah.
I think it goes back to what I think we spoke about in the last podcast around the issue of trust.
Mm.
People want good services. They want a lower cost of living. But when it comes to the crunch on when they're going to make their vote, it's about trust, and they know if there's a guarantee of a tax cut is more immediate to people,
yeah,
I think,
yeah,
than the longer term, you know, to fix the issues in health, housing and childcare is not, the immediate benefit is not.
Absolutely.
Going to
and Leo
be there.
Varadkar, I heard, he said that quite specifically. Yeah. He said, I will give you the money in your pocket where you can decide yourself how you spend it.
And of course, for politicians, it's a lot easier just to cut taxes than to actually do the hard work of policy reform and improving public services and making all of the institutional changes within a particular service that are required and that often take many years and that are often not acknowledged by the public for very understandable reasons. Whereas a tax cut, at the end of the day, it's the most populist thing you can do. People see the money in their pocket and they don't realise that it means less money for childcare, for public transport, for education, for health, for housing, for all of those things.
And you could see with Sinn Féin and People for Profit, for example, they were clearly, you know, the tax cuts that they were targeting were quite clear at the lower end in terms of lower paid, and they were very clearly, you know, trying to keep a very progressive tax system and introducing new taxes that would compensate for that in terms of on higher incomes and on wealth. But the problem is the principle is there and the idea is there, and it does kind of slip into that notion of taxes are bad and taxes are,
that's right,
you know, and of course the problem we have is the tax injustice that's there. And, you know, it was highlighted during the debate as well, you know, the corporations paying no tax, vulture funds, real estate trusts paying no tax. And it kind of shows that if you actually want to create a fair society where you have proper public services funded, you need a really progressive, strong tax system. But if you don't implement that on everybody, including the corporations, people won't buy into it. Yeah. And so it's kind of not just the Fine Gael kind of Fianna Fáil argument and, you know, we need to keep the taxes low on real estates and on vultures and on multinationals to keep the funding in. They don't think about, well, they don't care about, but, you know, in terms of understand, this has a huge knock-on impact in terms of society buying into our tax systems.
Tax. And of course, related to that is the fact that the corporation tax squeeze that we have currently going on will not last forever. And to be fair, the Department of Finance are now penciling in $2 billion by 2025 in terms of cumulatively how much less taxed will be. So we are coming into a place where the corporations are going to be paying more taxes, but they won't be paying it in Ireland. So there's going to have to be higher taxes paid by everybody else. And I suppose I just want to make one point about this. The corporations don't pay taxes. They don't, but you wouldn't necessarily be able to get them to pay more here. They're actually paying more than they otherwise would in Ireland already because they locate their intellectual property assets here. So the people that actually lose out are people in other countries, in the global south and in other advanced economies. So what we're actually doing is we're driving a getaway car. We're getting our cut. The multinationals robbed a bank, let's say, and then it's the people in the other countries that are actually losing out.
But we are losing out on the vultures and the real estate funds.
Absolutely,
who are
we
making huge profits from rents.
We absolutely are from those guys. It's true. But I guess I would caution about, let's say, assuming that if you increase or do something on the corporation tax side, you will gain billions of extra money.
Yeah.
The point is, the reason we're getting so much corporation tax receipts at the moment is because they're exploiting Ireland, and we're facilitating them, which allows them to pay less in other countries. Mm. And if that didn't exist in Ireland anymore, they would just pay the money in other countries. So there is no kind of magic tree or tree of money in that sense. Though there are other areas beyond looking at income where you can improve inequality. So taxes on wealth, taxes on inheritance are two obvious areas. The most significant form of inequality is actually intergenerational wealth transfer. Inheritances and gifts, which both basically come from parents, most wealth comes from that source. So what I would like to see...
And the figure is that the top 20% in Ireland of households own 70% of the wealth, and the bottom half own how much of the wealth, Tricia?
I don't know off the top of my head.
Tom?
5 to 10.
5%. The bottom half of the population of 5% of the wealth, which is really important when all the talk is about income inequality.
Yeah. So,
and nobody talks about the wealth inequality, which is where the huge money is made at the top.
You can currently inherit, 320,000 before paying a penny. On top of that, you get a gift of 3,000 from each parent, so 6,000 per year on top of 320,000. And if you're inheriting a business asset, it's got a 90% tax relief. So the business asset has to be worth significantly above 3 million before you pay a penny in tax. So you talk about your nurse on overtime paying your marginal rate of tax. You, for free, sitting on your couch, get to inherit over 3 million. You don't pay a penny.
Mm.
And that then perpetuates through generations. And in places like the United Kingdom, if you look at the people that are in the House of Parliament, you see your Camerons and Hagues. Mm. Those are all people that came over with William the Conqueror a thousand years ago.
And increasingly we're seeing as well that...
And it continues.
Yeah, as part of like the wealth that's held is not just land and housing and like, you know, in terms
financial
of people.
Assets.
It's financial assets. It's investments
business assets,
you know, in funds and things like that, where we're seeing this huge growth in inequality. And we're seeing that here as well. Tricia, do you think that a left government or a government, and not being party political now, because I know you can't be, but do you think from a perspective of addressing poverty and inequality that the current kind of dominant kind of economics we have had and dominant governments we have are likely to address that? Or if you had a government that, for example, put in place free childcare, increased tax on wealth, made corporations pay what they should be paying, their effective rate, invested properly in a public house building program, and, you know, say, for example, increased the PRSI or the social insurance on employers, invested in increased social welfare. Would that be an economy that would just scare away investment and business? Or do you think it would be a viable economic approach by a government?
I think the problem is when we think and talk about poverty, the concern is what people on low incomes are doing or how they're affected. And there's never, when you're talking about poverty, we're less concerned about the behaviour of those on the top incomes and in the top 1%. So without doubt, you need to consider all those factors when you're talking about poverty. It's not just good enough to think about how you can increase benefits, low incomes and improve services. You need to look at the whole picture on how you can address income inequality. And I suppose from a point of view that we would be making is there's a huge cost to the state in terms of poverty, a huge economic cost. So if people aren't compelled by a moral argument to address poverty.
Well, I think a lot of people are, but I think the economic one is important.
The economic argument to address poverty is very strong.
Mm.
So even in the UK, they did research on how much expenditure if poverty was eliminated, how much saving would be to the state in terms of less expenditure on healthcare, because there's huge health inequalities related to poverty, less expenditure on crime, less expenditure on housing and different areas as well, in terms of addressing the fallout from poverty and the impact that has on people's physical and mental health. And that's what we need to be talking about, because, okay, it will require spending now to deal with the issue, but there's going to be huge savings to the state in the future if you have a society that is equal And that is promoting and improving the standard of living for everybody. And it's not just us saying this, the OECD have said it. Mm. Economic models that promote equality, promote full employment and better economic outcomes as well.
Mm. And of course, the book that I continuously quote and research by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, The Spirit Level, and their more recent book, The Inner Level, shows the research is there. Countries like Sweden, Denmark, Austria, that actually, you know, are much more equal than Ireland, and not just income wise, but providing access to public services. There is a general better, they achieve better on well-being, on, you know, you talk about, you know, what it's absolutely, it is, you know, in terms of the investment, the economic perspective, it's cheaper for the state and we would have a, you know, less expenditure in that sense, but it's also better for everybody's well-being. You know, rates of crime drop, rates of, you know, social problems actually are lower in more equal societies. And I actually got quite struck by, you know, the recent violence that we've seen in terms of in communities related to drugs, but it's also extremely related to inequality, cuts to community projects, the lack of community services, the lack of community development, but also even in terms of violence, individual violence that's taken place also relates to inequalities as well, and, you know, how people interact and how their level of well-being. So, Tom, what do you think? Do you think that in terms of the policies that we've seen, there's a lot of scaremongering starting around, for example, the policies of Sinn Féin, that they would drive the investors away. And they're, you know, I've heard all sorts of derogatory phrases about their policies and others on the left, whether it's Labour or Social Democrats or the Greens, that they're pie in the sky and they're airy fairy. And what do you think? Are they reasonable points to make, or what do you think broadly of the proposals that have been made from the left parties?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that there's good bits and bad bits in all of the manifestos I've seen so far.
Don't be so diplomatic.
But having said that, I would make the point that we see countries already that you've just identified that have high tax, high spend models, and they do extremely well in terms of quality of life, in terms of employment, in terms of well-being. The Nordic countries, a lot of the Central European countries as well. So I think there is an element of scaremongering. There is a concern about kind of pushing at a cozy status quo. There is a kind of a self-satisfaction about how things are going for certain segments of society, and they don't want transformative change. And obviously there's party political interests that are at play here. But to answer your question, it is possible to have a high road model based upon a high labour share, where most or higher amounts of income go to workers as opposed to capital, where you still have low levels of unemployment, where you have low levels of poverty and deprivation, and you can do that with high taxes. But it depends on what you spend the money on. So if you're spending your money on defence and justice and things like that, you won't achieve much at all. I mean, look at the American model and all the money that's wasted there. But if the money is spent on things like childcare and education and free public transport and areas like that, you can have a much more, and infrastructure indeed, and research and higher level education, all of those things, you can have a very, very successful economy. So it depends upon the detail. But to give a short answer to your question, what business wants and what foreign investors want is a successful economy, which will have productive workers, and which is stable. And none of the seven manifestos that I've seen, will scare off investors. They have different models. Some of them are low road models about, we don't pay people a lot of money, so we're going to reduce their taxes rather than reducing the cost of living. Others are focused more at reducing taxes for low paid workers. So some are reducing taxes for high paid workers. Some are focusing more on public services. My own sense of it would be that the best way to approach this would be to reduce the cost of living and to focus on public services and on social benefits. There should be no tax cuts of any kind, in my view, in the budget, but, you know, that's a personal opinion coming at it from an economic viewpoint. We should focus on the long run perspective. That means dealing with climate change and biodiversity, and that will mean that will require making some hard choices on that end. But in terms of how you design an economy to be strong in 10 or 20 years' time, first of all, you look at your most important resource, and your most important resource are people. Start with children. They're going to be the working age people in 10, 20, 30 years' time. And focus on things like reskilling to deal with automation, just transitions, everything like that. So I am of the opinion that none of the manifestos are going to scare off investors, would be the way to answer your question. However, some of them have more of a high road approach to the economy, based upon high levels of employment, good quality of life for workers, a decent wage. What I'd like to see, in fact, which I haven't really seen, although I know all the manifestos aren't out yet, is a commitment to collective bargaining, a right to collective bargaining. That the evidence is extremely strong that collective bargaining and trade union density overall has very little impact on employment rates. But what it does do is it pushes up wages. Pushing up wages improves the labor share versus capital, and that improves income inequality in the economy because wealth is so concentrated in the population. It also leads to greater compression of wages within sectors, and that ultimately means less poverty and deprivation.
And to explain, what is collective bargaining?
Collective bargaining is the right of workers to come together under a trade union or as part of sectoral agreements and to benefit from those sectoral or firm level agreements. That what it does is it effectively counters. On one side, you have an employer who has a monopoly. It's just that one employer, and they are deciding what the wages are. On the other side, you have a disparate group of employees who, if they lose their job, the consequences are much more significant for them than for the employer losing that one worker. Mm. They just replace them with somebody else.
Yeah.
What having a union does is it allows all the workers to come together and be protected by being able to work together. So you can't just fire one worker for being in a trade union. You have to fire them all. And by striking and by holding back their labor, they gain leverage over an employer. And that puts them on an equal footing with the employer. Mm. So many economists would actually regard the absence of collective bargaining as being the market failure, because it means that one side has more power than the other. Having collective bargaining balances that out. Of course, it is a very, very hard fought debate. And you do have different perspectives from the right, but the evidence by and large doesn't back them up.
And you can see that in terms of there is a need for collective bargaining, in the sense that we have huge sectors of our workforce in the private sector, particularly low paid, who have no, you know, they're not in unions, they, you know, aren't the ability to be in unions in a sense of actually a culture supported in the workplace or being available. So that idea, we have a very low level of those protective agreements in sectoral workforces in comparison to other countries. Is it in any of the manifestos a proposal for it to introduce collective bargaining on a much greater level, or?
I haven't read the seven manifestos. I don't think they're all out yet, in fact. I haven't seen it so far. There was another two manifestos that came out yesterday. It may be in one or other of
Let's
those.
Let's see if it's in the programme for government.
But it would be very interesting to see if it were. Certainly, that would be a reform. It would be a very significant reform. Ireland doesn't have a right to collective bargaining in the way other European countries do. We do worse than other Western European countries in terms of employment rate. We do worse in terms of, we're only comparable.
Our proportion of low pay as well is very, very high.
Yeah. And again, it's all linked together.
Yeah. Tricia, climate change and the just transition. It's been talked a lot about in the election. Have you seen measures, or what measures do you think are going to, or have been there so far in the election debate, in the discussions around genuinely making an actual real transition to meet our targets? We know that I think it was the Green Party's proposal to reduce our carbon emissions by 7%. We had Professor John Sweeney on here from Maynooth, who said we actually need to be reducing our emissions by 10%. There seems to me anyway, to be an absence of an overall radical sense or a sense of the radical change that's needed to our society and economy to meet the targets. And rather than focusing on the herd or a carbon tax, there's this lack of an overall kind of sense of the emergency within the debate of like the wider structural change.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was one of the recommendations from the Oireachtas Committee on Climate Action was to establish a just transition advisory group to make, so we don't really have a coherent plan in terms of that. And I think a lot of the parties are proposing that there would be more planning in terms of that. So there's coherence across all sectors, that it's not just individual issues that are being, they bring together all social partners to discuss how collectively we can all work towards the climate action without leaving anybody behind. That's really important. And I think, you know, there is elements that will be welcome from us. You know, a lot of the parties are talking about investing in public transport, probably need to be talking about free public transport for everyone. Rural transport is a huge issue for, yeah, for us. It's just absolutely impossible for people to adjust their behaviour in rural Ireland and respond to a carbon tax if there's no alternatives. And yeah, there is no alternatives in rural Ireland. Transport is woefully underfunded. So we wanted to see greater investment in rural transport. Some parties are proposing that because electric cars are not on the horizon for people that we're supporting. It's just way beyond the bounds of where people are at. The other big issue is the retrofitting of housing.
Yeah.
Again, there's been lots of commitments there, and we would say that the first place you would start is with the houses, the deep retrofit of houses that the state owns.
Mm.
So a massive programme of retrofit for local authority housing. And that's something that is very achievable over the next programme for government. There's 150,000 houses in the possession of the state.
Yeah.
About 40% of those are over 40 years old. So you'd imagine they would need upgrades. And, you know, you're talking at a cost of maybe €40,000 to do a deep retrofit in and around. Then there's also capacity issues in terms of the sector and who will actually do that. So there's so many different components to it. It's going to be so important for the next programme for government that all sectors are coming out together to problem solve, provide the solutions that are going to address both business, voluntary sector, farmers, trade unions, so that we can have a coherent plan going forward that's going to benefit everybody and, most importantly, the climate.
And I think that, like, it is most importantly the climate, but it is how we survive and what type of society we have within our climate adjustment to meet the climate targets and to not just the targets, but actually to go beyond and create an environmentally sustainable economy and socially just one. And I do think that there is a real possibility, and it annoys me sometimes in the debate hearing the talk of the climate, and not, like, I think the climate justice and the change in the climate and our change to a socially just society, they have to be completely intertwined.
Yeah, absolutely. And there, it's sometimes implied, if you say just transition,
yeah,
that the point we're moving from is just.
Yes.
When it's not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you need
it's
to be,
just not.
Yeah.
Just.
Yeah. So, you know, we're moving from we need to make sure the transition from our current just position,
yes,
is,
no, our current unjust,
yes,
position.
Yeah, that's not, it's implied,
yes,
in the discussion.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's about, as we go back to it, you know, having the sustainable development goals are actually a really good framework because it, number one, is no poverty, and it has 15 goals that how we're going to sustainably survive and ensure no one is left behind. So
yeah, yeah.
It's really important that each of those issues are on equal footing and there's a proper dialogue and a bottom-up approach, getting it from the communities, people who are going to be affected, what, and engaging with people at a local level about it.
I was actually Orla Hegarty I was talking to, and she made a really good points about it that as she always does, around the whole issue. Because I was saying to her, you know, the state should pay for, yes, the social housing retrofitting, but it should pay for private, I think, private housing retrofitting. Because there's hundreds of thousands of people who have no possibility of being able to afford to retrofit their homes. So what are you going to do? Just constantly put more and more, you know, charges on them, or put, you know, expect them to do this and they just sit there languishing in cold houses and higher carbon taxes? Or do you just go, well, actually, we, you know, this is not just for you as an individual. This is for society and the planet. So my proposal is we set up a house building agency that goes and builds affordable housing and deep retrofits private and public housing. And she was saying, yeah, and, you know, that a lot of, for example, putting solar panels on roofs, putting communal, you know, wind energy, water harvesting could be done. But the electricity companies aren't in favour of it because they don't want people, you know, basically being self-sufficient and not paying huge electricity bills, that there's still huge, obviously the fossil fuel that's going beyond the fossil fuel industry, that we're still really not thinking of how could we actually make, you know, this society more socially just and environmentally sustainable, that we really have to move beyond the current kind of economic corporate dominated model, don't we?
And I think in terms of something that we had also suggested, we've asked for a long time, is this idea of a community energy advisor service like MABS, because there's going to be so many different supports that are available and people don't necessarily know what's available and how to link in. So it's a service that would link people in, advise them on their needs and how they maybe could access grants, because there is grants already available there and they're not being taken up, and understanding why they're not and how you could bridge those gaps. But the idea of a public body that would be building and also retrofitting housing is a good idea, I think, as well.
Tom, housing?
Yeah. I mean, it has been a number one issue, I think, in the election so far. And I think it is probably responsible for the undercurrent of discontent that is there.
Along with health.
Yeah. I think... But particularly for younger people, perhaps, the housing issue.
Yes, yeah.
And obviously we've seen...
And the poll shows that for the under 35s, housing is the primary concern.
Absolutely, and very understandably so. And what we've seen in the last couple of years, at least, is that wages have started to pick up. And that means that for non-renters, the disposable income is increasing and... quality of life perhaps is improving, but we are still seeing a group which is the renters, where wages are still not keeping pace with rents, and nowhere near. So you do have that cohort, and those are mostly people in their 20s and 30s that are falling further and further behind. So this is a major issue. And look, we've seen a lot of issues around the demand side. Help to Buy, we know, basically is a subsidy for developers effectively, which will ultimately just push up house prices. SSIA for housing, that'll just push up house prices. So it's not demand side measures.
Because it's supply side measures. Because if you're giving people more money to be able to buy, then the builders and developers know they have that extra money.
Right.
And also it's extra money chasing limited supply.
So you have four groups here. You have the builders, or the people selling the house. They obviously benefit to the tune of however many thousands. So that's like windfall gains for them from these policies. You have the people buying the house. They will probably benefit at the margin as well.
It's arguable. Yeah, in terms of they're paying.
Obviously, the taxpayer is losing out. Again, that's less money for education, childcare, social benefits, whatever, or indeed other tax cuts, whatever you're most interested in. But also the people that are not getting that house, the person who is not a first time buyer or who has already been saving, whatever, house prices just go up for them. So they just flat out lose out. So there are significant winners and losers associated with this. And overall, the impact of those policies, sometimes about Help to Buy and this SSIA for housing, are likely to be windfall gains for higher income households. So I see absolutely no value in those demand side housing policies. When you have a housing crisis, the idea that you try and accelerate demand through these windfall gains for particular households is crazy to me. Supply is the answer. And even if we were already producing 40,000 houses per year, it would still be a good idea to have a housing body that is in a counter-cyclical manner building houses, i.e., if you go below the equilibrium rate that you need in terms of houses, you step in and you build that amount of houses to take you up to that rate. And if there's lots of houses being built by the private sector at the moment, then you ease off on the gas. That needs to exist anyway. And now when we're in a reasonably strong fiscal position, and when we do in fact have a housing crisis, is the time to begin this process. The cost of borrowing on international markets is at historical lows. So it will never be cheaper from that perspective to borrow money. So you take the money you already have, the billions that are already there. You can leverage it if you want with extra borrowings. So access to capital is not an issue here. Now, there may be an issue in the sense that there just simply aren't enough construction workers around, and we're already seeing constraints and a lack of supply of construction workers. But I would see nothing wrong with bringing in workers from other countries, for example, which have high unemployment rates, like Spain, where there is a surfeit of construction workers available. So again, labour ultimately isn't a problem either. So that to me, treating it as a supply problem, and dealing with it in a counter-cyclical manner over the economic cycle, and then using that as a venting mechanism to prevent booms and busts, is the right way to approach this. That is what I'd like to see, and I'd like to see it done through some form of a cost rental model.
Great. Okay. I think we've done a fair go of analyzing the policies and putting forward solutions. I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. Do we think that irrespective, that this election has been a election where we're kind of seeing a shift to investment in public services? Do you think that's in healthcare and housing? Do you think?
Definitely. I think so.
Yeah. And so could we be seeing something different after this election?
Well, certainly the rhetoric has improved. I think the quality of the debate in Ireland has been better than I've seen in some other countries of late.
Mm.
There is a commonality in terms of the understanding that the desires of people and opinion polls and surveys bear this out, are more interested in improving public services than just getting extra cash in their pockets, and that's positive because it reflects the understanding that we're making these investments in reducing costs. There is a greater focus on public spending. Perhaps there hasn't been a focus in the debate on social benefits and social transfers. Mm. That's disappointing. Mm. There hasn't been a lack of realism over the climate emergency, and those figures of 7.6%, 8% that international bodies say we have to reduce by year on year haven't been reflected in the debate. So we're still living in fantasy land in that sense. But I do agree that there has been a greater focus on the need for higher levels of public spending versus tax cuts. And that shows a certain maturity that perhaps we haven't had in the past.
Tricia?
Yeah, definitely. And I think maybe something that hasn't really featured because of the nature of election and election cycles is just the long-term view on how dealing with demographic change.
Mm.
Even if we stand still, a lot of the costings are based on spending now rather yeah. than spending into the future. So that's a big challenge, but that's just the nature of
mm.
how election cycles work and obviously the democratic process. But I think even like when you're talking about housing, the big issue is that if renters are locked out, you're going to have huge problems with pensions later on because mm. the pension is set up for people who have their housing costs met already. It's always a challenge, the big long-term sustainable issues. But it's definitely there has been a shift in that more longer-term view rather than short-term gains for relatively little benefit for people. But definitely there's been a shift.
Mm.
But the challenges lay ahead anyway.
Definitely. Great, yeah. Great. Well, thank you so much. There's definitely lots to think about there. Lots of hopeful, lots of positive ideas. And we might get you in after the election, before the Programme for Government, to see can we set out what should be in the Programme for Government.
Yeah.
That would be great to have you back.
Yeah.
And to thank you so much for coming in.
No problem.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And thank you always to our listeners, and a shout out and a call. Some of you might be aware there's a protest taking place on the 5th of February, which is next Wednesday, for all the childcare childcare providers, creches and Montessoris, or most of them anyway, I think, are heading to Dublin for a very large protest, and we'll see if we can drag the kids into it. I think it's really important and great to see them actually standing up for proper investment. So if anybody wants to get in and support them on that day, please do. And as always, we put the call out for come sign up to us on Patreon. Thank you to the people who are signed up, but we need funding to keep this going. We're expanding all the time, putting on live shows, getting more and more shows out there to keep going, to show us you're interested, you care, and you love us. Go on to Patreon, put the money in, and help us keep the show on the road. Thank you.